My guest at this time is Christopher C. Horner. He is a senior fellow at the Competitive Enterprise Institute in Washington. Chris has joined us on many occasions to discuss the debate over climate change and specifically, in recent years, the Paris Climate Accords. And Chris, thanks as always for being with us.
Thank you, Greg.
You joined us a couple of months ago, March 17th to be precise, to explain why it was important from your perspective for President Trump to formally withdraw the United States from the Paris Climate Accords in short order. In fact, here is the timetable you gave for doing that effectively.
By May, it is clear we will have had to have made our position. So by May, I would say if President Trump doesn't get out of this in the next 2 months, probably 6 weeks, and certainly by the July G20 meeting in Hamburg, July 7th, 8th, then we are, again, if not now, when, then we're probably in this forever.
So 2 months later, still no decision. There's been supposed deadlines that have come and gone here, Chris. Why hasn't, first of all, any decision been made, and why haven't they scrapped it yet?
Well, we have to go back to the campaign and remember a decision was made, and it was to get out. And it was in, you can see it in the television ad being run by the Competitive Enterprise Institute that's also up on the web. It shows the president who serially made the promise he would get out, and he gave reasons why. He said that this would give others control over our energy use, whether how much we could use the things that are reliable and affordable and so on, as well as the massive wealth transfer. He made the decision. What's happened since is that decision was the brakes were put on it because different influences came into play. There were swamp, what I'll call swamp considerations, which were not obviously considerations in the campaign. In fact, he ran against the swamp. But once he got here, those interests are considerable. Tremendous business lobbies, tremendous the resistance, the holdovers. I could tell you blow by blow about a lot of these officials, as well as some Trump appointees. But as you also know, some family members feel and are exerting some what we'll call Manhattan social pressures to not have to defend keeping this promise in certain, I suppose, social situations. So those influences have led to the decision that was made now being put on hold, and every week delayed is obviously a bad sign because the decision had been made, and we're getting to the point where over the next few days, while the president, with those family influences and some other advisors who are trying to convince him to break this promise to get out of the Paris Treaty, are going to have his ear, as will the group of seven, the leading economic nations, who want, as a State Department cable I just found in some litigation shows, they want us to share the pain, to relieve the burden of our competition of not having this agenda saddling our economy. So he's going to have almost nothing but influences to do the wrong thing for the next 8 days.
Chris, you mentioned the business community. Usually when issues about emissions restrictions or other things related to the climate agenda come up, businesses usually aren't very excited about that, perhaps more manufacturing than some of the newer, internet-based digital-type businesses and so forth. So what are the elements from the business community that want to keep this in place?
Right. Well, it begins with the ones who invented this. I say that because I was in the room. It was 20 years ago this month when I found myself on behalf of Enron in a room with some utilities, a lot of green pressure groups, BP, the Gas Association, and so on, and they were trying to figure out how to get the Kyoto Treaty before there was a Kyoto Treaty. And the reason is simple. It's when you rob Peter to pay Paul, you're guaranteed Paul's enthusiastic support, and sometimes it was Paul's idea. So you've got this base of industry support, the ones who would benefit. In Enron's case, for example, they had just bought the world's largest windmill company. It's now GE Wind, but it was Zond, then Enron Wind. So you've got a lot of influences that would receive massive what we call rents through these schemes from the taxpayer, and they need this scheme in order to be even economic, let alone highly profitable. So you've got them. You've got a lot of the oil folks figure that the future will be in gas, and they've got, just by nature of their business, tremendous gas reserves. So there are some obvious players and then some less obvious players, and a lot of them have come out recently saying, look, we've planned for this, and the bigger players have always, this is what gives the business lobby a bad name. They love instituting new policies that are barriers to entry to new participants or that smaller competitors can't handle as well. So some businesses were actually publicly saying in news reports that, look, we've planned for it, so we need this to happen. We spent a lot of money expecting it, and other people won't be able to deal with it that well. So it's a little counterintuitive, and it's certainly contrary to what the media portrays it as.
Chris, a couple of quick follow-ups here. First of all, what voices, if any, are there on your side of this debate in the president's ear? I would imagine the EPA administrator would be one of them, but how balanced is the presentation he's getting right now?
He's getting solid advice from the EPA administrator, and of course that's not his lift, so maybe that's not unexpected. But the UN ambassador, Nikki Haley, is reportedly very strong on this, even though, as I've said before, state will do what's in the State Department's interests, and this makes Rex Tillerson's life more difficult, not easier. And so he's a strong advocate of just not adding this to his burden. Nikki Haley, the UN ambassador, who's going to have to deal with the French and so on, and the tantrums we saw over the Kyoto Treaty. And she is fighting the good fight. You've got the base. You've got some industry, the energy consumers, people who realize they use a lot of energy. This is a major input, major bottom line item for them, have said, look, you can't – this. We have an energy cost advantage in the United States. It's a reason that an awful lot of jobs are here now in the last few years. So you've also got the traditional limited government groups and so on who have fought this since the beginning, an often very lonely fight. But that's it. There's no doubt that we are less equipped to prevail in a sustained, prolonged battle than the legacy media, the big business and so on who are lobbying for this scheme.
Chris, you don't sound too optimistic. Do you believe that if he was going to withdraw, he would have done it already?
That seems to be the reasonable conclusion. I don't think all is lost. We know we got it on fairly good authority what the president still thinks. He wants out and wonders aloud why he can't just keep his promise. But again, he's surrounded by influencers saying, well, you can't do it for the following reasons. But some people are saying, well, you have to for these reasons, the same reasons you said you would. So having been dealt almost nothing but defeats in these battles for a long time, we have to remain cautiously pessimistic. But again, for the first time, we have a president who's saying, I saw what this is about. He told the Washington Post in an editorial board meeting what he saw this is about. He said a lot of people are making an awful lot of money on this, and he wasn't saying that as a compliment. It's not necessarily an inherently good thing if you're just creating inefficiencies to reward cronies. And he knows that's what this is about. The question is, will he be able to overcome some very strong influences and keep his promise? We hope he will. Yeah, we hope he will. But we have some level of confidence that he will. We have to. He was so clear. And not just once, repeatedly. And it wasn't offhand.
And what does it tell you if he doesn't?
Well, it means the swamp isn't as easily defeated as a lot of people hoped. This really is, if you go through the players, between the holdovers at state and even some appointees, and the interests at play and who benefits, a tremendous climate diplomatic corps for the State Department, a tremendous boost in budget, or a tremendous reduction. Which do you think they're fighting tooth and nail for? So this is really the ultimate, so far as we've seen, the ultimate test of his battle against the swamp.
You've explained a number of reasons why you believe it's imperative for the United States to withdraw. But for an American who's not involved at the leadership of a manufacturing or in the business community, what's this going to mean for day-to-day life for most Americans?
President Obama put it best. He said, I'm going to cause your electricity rates to necessarily skyrocket. But that was just he was discussing that as part of one part of the first promise of the Kyoto of the Paris Treaty. Now, he was saying that about the first component of the first tranche of the Paris Treaty's commitments. This treaty will require that your energy prices, your federal government and states impose laws to make your electricity rates and all of your energy consumption and everything that involves energy embedded in this price, which is everything, the price to go up, leaving you with less disposable income and a less resilient lifestyle, less healthy because you're less wealthy, more hypothermia, more people, seniors and the vulnerable dying from energy poverty. So that's what it's going to mean to you. And with a tighter regime, mandatorily, every 5 years, forever, because they realize they don't want our Senate to have anything to do with it. Don't accept that.
We'll be watching. Chris, thanks very much, as always, for helping us understand better.
Thank you, Greg.
Christopher C. Horner, Senior Fellow at the Competitive Enterprise Institute in Washington. I'm Greg Corumbus, reporting for Radio America.